the first category of Torah, the level of prophecy is when God speaks to Moshe clearly, the way I'm speaking to you. Moshe hears the words, and Moshe writes down the words. Our belief is, we studied this last year when we talked about the fundamental beliefs of Judaism, our belief is that the words of the Torah are directly dictated by God to Moshe. Moshe was nothing more than a dictationist, than a secretary who wrote down word for word what God said.
Right.
That's the first level of prophecy. That is a level of prophecy that we assert no other human being has reached, that Moshe could understand God speaking clearly like I'm able to understand you and you're able to understand me. That's the first portion, the five books of the Torah. The second section is the works of the prophets, the Nevi'im. There, it's a lower level of prophecy, meaning God shows a prophet an image or a vision, and then the prophet selects the words to describe that image. I gave examples this past Shabbos. I was quoting from the book of Yeshayahu. Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Malok kol ha'aretz kvodo. The entire world is filled with God's glory. So our understanding of that is that God... I didn't mean to imply this past Shabbos that Yeshayahu came up with that idea on his own. God showed him a vision, and Yeshayahu used his words to express the vision that God had showed. That's the works of prophecy. The writings of the Ksuvim is yet a lower level of prophecy. In fact, the term that we would use is that they are not works of prophecy per se, they are rather works that were written by people who were moved by divine inspiration. And what I mean to say by that is, what is a prophet? A prophet is a man or a woman who is so holy and so pure and is so spiritually developed that God decides I can communicate directly with that person. Now, God can...
I don't think God speaks to everybody, but not everybody's at that level that they can understand what he's saying.
I think God speaks in a special way to prophets. Let me leave that to the side for a moment. But God speaks to prophets. Now, God can say lots of different things. God can say lessons that the prophet should share with the world, or lessons that the prophet should share with the Jewish people. And those are written down and contained in the books of prophecy, because if they're written down and included in the books of prophecy, that means by definition that they have a lesson for the Jewish people for all time, or for the world for all time, if they're addressed to other nations of the world. That's the standard by which prophecies get included in the Torah. However, I mean, it's possible that God could speak to a prophet about something personal that's not meant to be shared with anybody else. And clearly, there are other times when God is not speaking to the prophet. A person, I would assume, can go for years and maybe decades without hearing from God. But the person remains a person on the level of being able to hear God. Now, if that person, not when God is speaking to him, but that person writes something, that person is moved by divine inspiration. And what that can mean, in very simple terms, what that can mean is a person can write, let's just say, a poem. So the poem can have meanings beyond the conscious intention of the writer, and those meanings can be prophetic. Meaning, if a person is inspired by divine inspiration, God can sometimes use that person's product, that person's writing or words or songs, whatever it is, as a way of expressing certain ideas, even if the person does not intentionally mean for it to be. Just to give you an example, King David wrote Psalms. Now, King David was a prophet. God spoke to him. We have prophecies written by King David. But he also wrote Psalms, which are poems, songs. Now, we understand that some of those songs, some of those psalms, refer to events that did not yet happen to King David. In that sense, they are, I'm not sure I want to use the word prophetic, but they are certainly foreshadowing. They are not prophecy per se. God didn't give a vision and say, write this down of what's going to happen. Rather, it's a person who is moved by the divine spirit and is able to say things that have meanings beyond the human intention. That's the section of the writings. And in a sense, it makes it the portion of the Torah that is the most personal, the most passionate in a certain sense, but also allows us to interpret on multiple levels. Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, was written by King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, David's son. It's one of five Megillot. There are five from this book that are called stories or narratives. The Book of Ruth, we read that on Shavuos. The Book of Echa, we read that Lamentations, we read that on Tisha B'Av. Koheles, Ecclesiastes, we read that on Sukkot. Esther, we read that, of course, on Purim. And Shir HaShirim, we read that on Pesach. Chol HaMoed, the Shabbos of Chol HaMoed, Pesach, in the middle of Pesach, we read that during services in the morning. Shlomo HaMelech wrote three works. He wrote Shir HaShirim. He wrote Mishlei, Book of Proverbs. And he also wrote Koheles, the Book of Ecclesiastes. Now, again, if it is part of the Torah, that means that it's not only a personal work, it's not only an individual work, it is a work that holds lessons for the Jewish people for all time. And just very, very briefly, the theme and the lesson of Shir HaShirim, of the Song of Songs, is the theme of the closeness to God. It's the closeness between God and the Jewish people, and the closeness of God to every individual. That's going to be the subject matter that we're going to be looking at. I have a very personal relationship to this particular work of Shir HaShirim, and I want to share part of it with you because it's important to understanding the way we're going to study it. A few weeks ago, I talked about defining modern Orthodoxy. And one of the things that I talked about was one component of what modern Orthodoxy is concerns the subject of secular knowledge. Different groups of Jews relate differently to the subject of secular knowledge. There are some Jews who believe that any knowledge outside of Torah wisdom is inherently unimportant, and therefore this group of Jews does not engage in the study of secular knowledge. There's a group of Jews that believes that secular knowledge has a utilitarian purpose. That is, if you needed to earn a living, there are certain subjects that are worthwhile to study because they are necessary to get through daily life. And then there is a group of Jews who believes that secular knowledge can enhance and deepen one's appreciation of Torah knowledge. And that is what I defined as part of the definition of modern Orthodoxy, and I gave some examples of how that works. One of the best examples that I could give is the study of Shir HaShirim. I first studied Shir HaShirim in an intensive way after I graduated from college. When I studied, when I went to college, I majored in literature, the study of literature, and the authors that I concentrated on are Virginia Woolf, Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, and James Joyce. Those four really were the bulk of the work that I did. And what I learned from those authors in particular is several lessons. Number one, how to take a text that appears very simple. It appears on the surface to be a very simple text, and to look at it and to see the tremendous complexity that is within that text. And another thing I learned was how to be able to carry several strands of meaning at the same time. That is, a certain text can be meaningful on several layers at the same time, and then you have to follow all the layers as you go through the work in order to understand it. Another thing that I learned, and this is especially important in modern literature, is how, for example, the point of view can change. The speaker can change. Even the tense, the grammar can change even within a sentence. And it appears to be very strange, and yet if you study it, you see a certain importance in why the narrator is first one person and then the narrator is another person, why the point of view changes from here to here, what's the difference between past tense and present tense and future tense and other tenses, and to be able to see the meaning of those kinds of what appear on the surface to be random changes really have a very deep meaning. Everything that I learned about literature helped me to understand Shir HaShirim when I studied it. And I do not mean to say that we are going to study Shir HaShirim as literature, because a lot of people would understand that to be a put down. If Shir HaShirim is part of the Torah, to say it's literature is somehow to demean it. I don't mean to suggest that. I mean to suggest it's Torah, it is holy, it's sanctified, but at the same time, the methods that we use to study literature can be used to study Shir HaShirim and can deepen our appreciation of what this work means. And I want to give you a suggestion. If you want a secular way to prepare, an easy secular way to prepare for this series, because we're going to study it together for a number of weeks, there's a movie that's out, and it's called The Hours. So I want to suggest that you go to see it. Now, the best thing to do is to read Virginia Woolf's novel, Mrs. Dalloway, which is one of her best novels, and then to see the movie. But even if you see the movie by itself, there are a number of techniques within that movie that are going to be helpful to studying Shir HaShirim. And I'm going to be talking about this a little more as we go along, but it's good practice. It's good preparation for the kind of study of a story that exists on several different layers that are intertwined, and you have to carry all of them through as you go along. That's a good model for what we're going to do with Shir HaShirim. If you want to translate that into a Jewish context, if you look at the other side of this sheet of paper, this is a standard way within classical Jewish thinking of interpreting classical Jewish texts. And if you look at the letters that I have underlined, you will see that they spell the word pardes. The word going from top to bottom. The word pardes means an orchard. Pardes means an orchard. And this is a metaphor for, so to speak, entering the orchard of Torah wisdom. And the words, the letters each stand for a different word, which are understood to be different levels of meaning of any Torah text. So the first is pshat, then remez, then drush, and then sod. Now, I've given my own translations of these terms, and we'll talk about them as we go along. Pshat means the surface meaning. That's what most of us deal with in our daily lives. If you come to Shul on Shabbos and the parsha, the Torah portion is being read, and you follow along in the English translation, so that's basically the pshat, the simple, I don't like to use the word the simple meaning, but the surface meaning, what the words translated mean on the simple outer surface level. That's the level, certainly, in our prayers. If we read the English translation to our prayers, we're dealing with mostly the pshat level. There's a deeper level called remez, and I would translate that as symbolic meaning. In other words, everything is a symbol. A symbol means it has a deeper meaning beyond the level of the text. I'm going to give you an example of this in just a moment. Let me just go through all four. Drush, I've translated as associative meaning. And what I mean to suggest by that is, drush means there is another subject that is connected to this word, but the other subject is not related to this subject. Okay? It's associated, but it's not related. And then the deepest level is sod, which is the hidden meaning. Sod is often connected to Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism. It is usually very esoteric, very difficult to understand, very open to misinterpretation. And so Jewish scholars will write about these four levels, Pshat, Remez, Drush, and Sod. Hasidic interpretations will usually emphasize the level of Remez. Halachic interpretations, those interpretations that extrapolate Jewish legal opinions from verses in the Torah, are working on the level of Drush. Sod, as I said, is usually emphasized by those people working in Kabbalah Jewish mysticism. And then Pshat, the first level, is the level of that we relate to. So just to give you an example, let's just take the story of creation in the Torah, for example. So the Torah has a narrative of what happened on the first day and the second day and the third day, and then Adam is created and Eve, and they name the animals, and that's the story. So if you read through the story as it happens, that's Pshat, that's the surface meaning of what happens. On the first day this is created, on the second day that was created. Remez, the symbolic meaning, might look at the symbolic meaning of what is created on each of the 6 days of creation. For example, on the second day of creation, there was a separation of the waters that are above and the waters that are below. So our sages maintain that second day is a day of division. It's a day on which pirud, distinctions, apply. There's a custom, it's not so well followed today, but there's a custom not to have weddings on the second day of the week, on a Monday, because it's a day of separation, not a day of union. So to allegorize...
You know, I've gotten married on a Monday.
But I said it's not applied today. But within certain communities, they will be very careful which day of the week would a wedding take place. That's not the custom in our community. It's great. Wednesday's fantastic. Wednesday's fantastic. So the level of remez would deal with the symbolic meaning of what was created on that day. Drush would relate to the drushos, the associated meanings. For example, a halachic practice that is extrapolated from one of the verses. And then sod would look at the deepest level, would look at hidden meanings. What is being described about God's essence in the way that these things are created? How is God's identity somehow being expressed by the words that used to describe the creation of the world? So, and that would be on a very esoteric, Kabbalistic, mysterious level. So every narrative can be dealt with on these different layers. This is particularly important when it comes to Shir HaShirim, because we are going to be studying Shir HaShirim on all four of these levels simultaneously. And it's going to be necessary, and we'll have to become practiced at being able to maintain in our minds how one word can have really four different meanings at the same time, but the meanings interact with each other. And we'll see this as we go along. So just to foreshadow what we're going to see with Shir HaShirim, the narrative of Shir HaShirim on the level of pshat, of surface meaning, is a narrative of a lover and a beloved. It's the story of a lover and a beloved as they court each other, as they come closer, as they draw apart, as their relationship develops. That's the pshat level. The remez level, the symbolic level, and this is followed in particular by the commentary of Rashi, but others as well, and that is the history of the relationship between God and the Jewish people is expressed in the terms of this lover and this beloved. So what is really being told is the story of the history of the relationship, sometimes closer, sometimes further apart, between God and the Jewish people. On the level of Drush, I will show you there are many, many lessons to be learned from the verses of Shir HaShirim. There are lessons in behavior of how we, our attitude towards the land of Israel is a very, very important theme. Lessons about marriage, lessons about love, religious lessons that we will see, many, many different areas, and we will study them together, and they are associative lessons. That is, they don't flow within the text itself, but our sages have understood that they are associated through their connection to these verses. And then the deepest level is Sod, and that I would suggest is the story of the relationship between God and each individual. And we're going to see that as well. The narrative is really about how each individual relates to God. And what is the nature of that relationship? How to deepen that relationship? So that's how Shir HaShirim works on these four levels. Now, there's always been a tremendous controversy concerning this work about the level of pshat. The remez, the drush, and the sod, that's covered adequately by commentators, and we will see them, and we will see it, but there's been tremendous controversy about the level of pshat for Shir HaShirim. Let me show you what I mean. If you take a look at this art scroll sitter, the black sitter, and you turn to page 298. You will see, page 298, you will see Shir HaShirim. You will note that unlike the rest of this entire volume, there is no translation. There is a commentary below the line, which are points of commentary about Shir HaShirim, but there's no translation. And basically what Art Scroll decided is Shir HaShirim should not be presented on the level of pshat, because the level of pshat is too easily misunderstood, because the person reads the translation thinks it's about a lover and a beloved. And there's talk of all sorts of adult subjects, like body parts, and it's not the kind of thing that... And so people could very easily think that this is just some type of folk love tale and misunderstand it on that level. And therefore they chose, this edition chooses, to eliminate the level of pshat and only to present comments on the levels of remez and drush and sod, which is their commentary. Now, that attitude flows from a passage in the Gemara. The Talmud says, it's Tractate Sanhedrin, Talmud says, it is prohibited to make out of Shir HaShirim secular songs. It's prohibited to use the words in a secular context. It's not the right thing to make up love songs between one person and another, one human being and another, from the words of Shir HaShirim, which, by the way, is very commonly done, notwithstanding the Talmud's prohibition. But certainly in Israeli music, for example, it's very common to hear references to different words, Anila Dodi Vadodi Li, and other kinds of quotes. And the Talmud is concerned about misunderstanding it as a simple human tale. And so the art school chooses to eliminate the level of pshat. I must tell you that I take exception to Art Scroll's approach, because I think that Shir HaShirim can be understood on the level of pshat without being misunderstood as a simple human love song. And if you take a look at the Birnbaum, so we're not going to use the Art Scroll. If you want to use it, be my guest. But I'm going to be using the Birnbaum. If you take a look at the Birnbaum, let's see where this is. On page 221, you know there are two editions of the Birnbaum. There's a daily Birnbaum, and there's the Shabbos and holiday Birnbaum. It is not included in the Shabbos and holiday Birnbaum, which is rather ironic because many people actually say this on Shabbos, but it is included in the daily Birnbaum, which is what you have here on the table. And starting on page 221, you have the Hebrew text, you have the English translation on the level of pshat, and you have to understand this. That's what we're going to be doing together. So if you want to bring your own edition, that's fine. If you want to use this, we'll use this. Whatever you want to use, that's fine. I just want to show you how this issue of looking at the different levels is somewhat controversial. We are going to try to use all four of these levels and to try to understand them on the basis of classical commentators. Now, I want to do something else for a few minutes that is the last part of this introduction. And if you'll excuse me, because I'm going to stand over here for a couple of minutes, because I want to use this. What I want to do, since one of the main levels of understanding Shir HaShirim is the historical level, I want just to review. So we're now going to have a 15-minute review of Jewish history. Just the highlights. But specifically the events that we're going to see covered in Shir HaShirim, and to have a familiarity as we go through the text. And by the way, the text doesn't go in chronological order. The text goes in certain thematic order, so events are chronologically jumbled somewhat. So we have to have a familiarity with what goes on. On the top, you see the Jewish dating, starting with creation at zero and going to our present, which is 5,763, which is right about here. You see, we are, if you assume, I spoke about this once before, Jewish history being a total of 6,000 years and what that means and what happens after 6,000 years, but in any event, we're coming to the end of that 6,000-year period. I've spoken about this before also, and I don't want to dwell on it, but remember that this system of dating has nothing to say about scientific opinions of the age of the world. There are a number of ways to reconcile what science says about the age of the world and this system. It could very well be that the first 6 days of creation. Each one of those days was a billion years, or a hundred billion years, or however many you want. Actually, I just listened to an amazing speaker last night who was giving a Dvar Torah. He quoted a Medrash that said that on the first week of creation, Adam was created on a Friday morning. So there's a Medrash that says that from Friday morning, for 36 hours, that is the rest of Friday, Friday night, and all of that first Shabbos day, the sun never set. So actually, Adam encountered the first 36 hours of his life were exclusively illuminated by the light of the sun. And it was only at the end of the Shabbos was their first sunset. Okay, I'm not even sure what that means, but if there was no sunrise and sunset on that first Shabbos, it could very well be that that lasted 15 billion years. So there are lots of ways to reconcile. I don't know. Maybe it was some other different system. There's no way to know. There are a lot of different ways to reconcile that. But the dating system that we use for historical purposes starts at zero, goes to 5,000 to 6,000. We're almost up to that. Basically speaking, Abraham was born in the year, using these dates, in the year 1948, which makes it just before the 2000 mark. The second temple is destroyed close to the 4000 mark, okay? So, from the second temple destruction until our time, that is the exile that we are currently experiencing, the experience of Jews in Rome and in Europe and Spain, etc., that's basically this third of history. This first part is the story of the narrative of Bereshis, of creation, and then Noach up to Abraham. That's all third. And then from Abraham until the destruction of the Second Temple is, again, approximately this middle third, this middle 2,000 years. Okay?
That's when all the good things happen.
That's when, and certainly the stuff that we're going to be looking at. Now, in this first 2,000 year period, God, so to speak, doesn't have many human friends. I mean, as we study Bereshis, you know, there's a flood at the time of Noah. Noah and his family, the only ones that are saved. I mean, clearly there's not a whole large community of people who are caring about what God says and wants them to do. So God is somewhat without human beings to deal with, right? Until the time of Abraham. So Abraham is the first person that on his own chooses God. Abraham recognizes on his own that there is a creator. And for the first time, so to speak, God has, be misunderstood, but God, so to speak, has a human friend. That is, there's a human being who is sensitive to God's wishes, and that's really the first relationship that God has. God rewards Abraham by saying, "Your children I will take to me as a people. And after they endure the suffering in Egypt, I will take them out of Egypt, I will give them the Torah, and I will give them the land of Israel." That's really the contract that God makes with Abraham. So, Jewish history really starts in Egypt. I mean, it's very interesting, but of course, the Jewish people are made into a nation in Egypt. They go down as a family. Yaakov and his family go down to Egypt, and in Egypt they become a people. When they come out of Egypt, they are a Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people.
Did they get a lot of converts from the Egyptian people?
I would assume they did. But the creation, the fulcrum of the creation of the Jewish people is not Israel, but it's Egypt. Okay, that's going to be very, very important to us, as we will see. Right, that's true. Now, if you think in human terms, you can see that the moment of leaving Egypt is what I would refer to as the engagement. between God and the Jewish people. It's the time when they are committing to each other. God is committing to the Jewish people by saying, I'm going to take you out of Egypt and I'm going to take care of you. And the Jewish people is committing to God by saying, I'm willing to go with you into the desert. Now, I'm going to talk about this later at greater length. And I've also shared this with some of you before, but we need to keep in mind what it must have taken for the Jewish people to have left Egypt to go into the desert. I mean, you got to keep in mind, we're talking about going into a desert where there is no water without any supplies, without any supply of water. So there is a level of dependence and a level of trust that is absolutely unbelievable. And when you, if you ever experience it yourself, of what it feels like to be in the desert without water very close by, the level of dependence and trust you must have is absolutely amazing. We're going to come back to this. This is a very, very important theme.
So where did all those wells come from?
Well,
an underground lake?
No, after they left, the Torah tells us that after they left, the people said, where's the water? We need water. We're thirsty. Where's the water? I mean, what's incredible is that they didn't say that before they left Egypt. They didn't say, Moshe, okay, we'll leave, but so the Torah tells us there was a be'er, there was a well that traveled with them that miraculously provided water. Okay, so we're going to come back to that subject, but just keep in mind, I would call it the engagement because it is a moment where there is a connection between God and the Jewish people. The Jewish people travel for 7 weeks, 49 days, so they get to Mount Sinai. And at Mount Sinai, they receive the Torah. God reveals himself at Mount Sinai. And that moment would be the moment of marriage, the moment of consummating their relationship. And by the way, the sexual imagery is also very important, the moment of the deepest contact between God and the Jewish people. And in fact, the sexual metaphor, I'm going to come back to the sexual metaphor, but the sexual metaphor is really emphasized by this mountain. And you have Moshe going to the top of the mountain, and the Medrash says that God descends until the mountain, and you really have this idea of an image of intercourse, interaction between God and the Jewish people. God reveals himself to the entire Jewish people in a way that had never happened in human history, and we believe never will be duplicated in human history. So the entire Jewish people comprehended God and heard God speak clearly, as Moshe did in his prophecies. So that was a moment of the most intense closeness that ever existed, that will ever exist between God and the Jewish people. So that moment is going to be a very, very significant moment within Shir HaShirim. It's going to be referred to a number of times. After the Jewish people receive the Torah, they then are in the desert for 40 years. And again, those 40 years are clearly preparation, in some sense, for entering the land of Israel. There are lessons to be learned about what life will be like when they get into the land of Israel. And clearly there is this total dependence. The Jewish people are living on man, the manna, which is miraculously appearing every day. They're living on the basis of this well of water, which miraculously follows them along. So there is a supernatural existence, and it is obviously a time of intense, what you might refer to as a honeymoon, an intense period of closeness just after this moment of marriage. Then the Jewish people enter the land of Israel. So they enter the land of Israel right around here. And then follows a period of 400 years that I would say is the exact opposite of what preceded it. That is the period that we refer to as the Shoftim. First, Joshua, and his armies conquer the land of Israel. And then there's a period of Shoftim. The Shoftim means the judges. One of the books of prophecy of the Navi is the book of Shoftim. And it covers this period. And it is a period of complete decentralized government. There's no king. There's no leader. Everybody is just on their own. And so the relationship with God starts to weaken because people are doing their own thing and they're concentrating on farms and developing their property and living their lives, but the relationship between God and the Jewish people kind of weakens. And one of the things I want you to pay attention to is how each of these eras in Jewish people, I'm sorry, in Jewish history, is like a pendulum, because things swing back and forth, as they do in historical cycles. So you have this period of intense closeness. Now we need a little bit of space for a while. They need a little bit of space for a while. It's a period of 400 years. The people deteriorate somewhat spiritually. There's a little bit of idolatry going on. The book of Ruth is written during that period of time. And then that's followed by another shift. Along comes King David. Along comes King David, David HaMelech, and David HaMelech builds the first Beis HaMikdash. Now, you know, of course, we're studying in the Torah currently the building of the Mishkan. So, in the desert, God commanded the Jewish people to build the Mishkan, the tabernacle. It's this structure, it's modular, they can take it down and move it and walk with it. It has these items inside, like the ark and the menorah and the table, etc. And the Mizbeach, the altar with the offerings and the sacrifices. So that moves around with them. And when they come into Israel, that is located in a city called Shiloh, which is just north of Yerushalayim. And then finally, I apologize. I will...
I know where you are.
I'm sorry. Forgot I had that in my pocket. I'm sorry. And then finally, King David, David HaMelech, is anointed as the first king, not really the first king, but the first king of the Davidic line. And David HaMelech says, we're going to build a permanent structure of a place to serve Hashem. So that is right around here, in the middle of this middle period, right around here. And David HaMelech starts to build a magnificent Beis HaMikdash, the Holy Temple in Yerushalayim. It is a beautiful structure, an awe-inspiring structure. It is the heart of the Jewish world. It's the heart of the Jewish world because this is the spot where the Jewish people meets God. It's the spot where the Jewish people serves God in a tangible, overt, open way. It's also the heart of the Jewish world because it is where the entire Jewish people gather. Remember, I talked about this a few weeks ago. The entire Jewish people gathers to the Beis HaMikdash every festival. And so it is literally and figuratively and metaphorically the heart of the Jewish people. So, again, the pendulum swings back the other way, because now you have a structure that is bringing a much greater level of closeness between God and the Jewish people. I've shared with you before the reign of King David and his son, King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech. David HaMelech, King David, started the preparations for the first temple. It was actually constructed and finished by Solomon. That era is still referred to as the golden era of Jewish history. That is the time when the Jews are in Israel, safe, secure. There is a government, there is a monarchy. It's a religious monarchy. It's a humane monarchy. The level of religiosity of the Jewish people is probably at its highest average level, meaning the widest number of Jews observing God's Torah as it was meant to be observed. So we refer to that, I would refer to that as the golden period of Jewish history. So again, the pendulum has swung back from the period of Shoftim, where there was this kind of laissez-faire, everybody doing what they wanted. Now you come to back to this period of closeness and intimacy between God and the Jewish people on this basis. The first temple, the first Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, stands for approximately 400 years. And then after, as time goes on, it too starts to deteriorate. As I've shared with you before, after the death of King Shlomo HaMelech, there's a civil war. Then the Jewish people are divided into a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. So you have these deep divisions. Especially in the northern kingdom, there is the beginnings of idolatry again. And then come these prophets who start to warn the people, you're not doing the right thing, you better change your ways, you better improve, things are going to be bad for you if they continue this way. And so we have a gradual deterioration. And there's a little bit of improvement, but then there's more deterioration. Until finally, the northern kingdom is exiled. You know that when the northern kingdom is exiled, they are lost. That's the 10 northern tribes, they are lost to the Jewish people until our day. We still don't know where they are. The southern kingdom that contains Jerusalem is ultimately destroyed by the Babylonians. It's destroyed, and the rest of the Jews are exiled to Babel. Babel is the area that is between Iran and Iraq. So you have this period of about 400 years of intense closeness that then the pendulum comes back the other way and leads to a period of persecution, destruction, and exile. The Jewish people are exiled to Babel, to Babylonia. There is a prophecy that the exile will only last about 100 years. And in fact, at the end of that time is when the Purim story happens. The Purim story, the aftermath of the Purim story is the fact that the Jewish people are able to go back to Israel and rebuild the second Beis HaMikdash. Now, the second temple, the second Beis HaMikdash, also lasts for about 400 years. It is, again, the pendulum swings back. You have the closeness during the first Beis HaMikdash. You have the distance of the exile. And then it comes back during the second Beis HaMikdash. You again have this closeness. Of course, you realize, if you put a pendulum in motion, it starts out by going all the way to this side, and then all the way to the other side. But you realize, each time it goes back and forth, it goes a little bit shorter. So, the second Beis HaMikdash doesn't quite come back all the way to the level of closeness and intimacy as the first Beis HaMikdash. The first Beis HaMikdash is not quite as intimate and close as the encounter at Sinai. Each time there is a shift back and forth, it gets muted just a little bit. So the second Beis HaMikdash, and we'll study this later, the second Beis HaMikdash in a number of ways was not as grand, was not as inspiring as the first Beis HaMikdash. Let me give you a couple of examples. During the 400 years of the second Beis HaMikdash, most Jews did not live in Israel. In the first Beis HaMikdash, almost all Jews lived in Israel. Most of the Jews in Babel, the majority of Jews in Babel, did not come back to Israel for the second Beis HaMikdash. The Talmud says, had the majority of Jews come back to Israel for the second Beis HaMikdash, that second Beis HaMikdash never would have been destroyed.
But I understand that 200 years before the Common Era, the Jews were living in Spain and Portugal already and in France.
Oh, well, 400 years before. Sure, sure. But the point is they didn't come back to Israel. Israel was available and they didn't come back. And there are some very important parallels for our own time. So, the majority of Jews are outside of Israel. There is no Jewish sovereign. You know, there are no Jewish kings during the second Beis HaMikdash. There's the Hanukkah story and the Hashmonaim. They are leaders. And then there are Roman leaders, Herod, Agrippus, etc., who are at the head of the in power in Israel during the Second Temple period. That also declines during the Roman era.
Right before that?
Yeah, he was at the beginning of this period. The Second Temple declines. That is, the spiritual level of the Jewish people declines until finally, about 2,000 years ago, the Second Temple is destroyed. And then the Jewish people are exiled again, and that exile lasts until our own time. It's amazing that the second temple is destroyed, the Jewish people goes into exile, and of course you know, and we're going to look at this in depth, when the Jewish people goes into exile, the land of Israel, so to speak, goes into exile. The land of Israel becomes barren and unproductive. And that's a really interesting subject, and this is what we're going to see in Shir HaShirim, is what does it mean for us in the last 100 years? The way in which Israel physically has changed in the last 100 years has tremendously deep implications for our understanding of our relationship to Israel and our relationship to God. And what that means for the end of the book of Shir HaShirim is very, very important in those terms. But in any event, those are the different periods in history that you need to know. So you know the relationship God had with individuals, the time of Abraham, the beginning of the relationship in Egypt, the height of the relationship at Sinai, the pendulum swinging back and forth of the period of the Shoftim on the one hand, the first base of Mikdash, the exile, the second base of Mikdash, and then our exile. And then what looks like a pendulum swinging back one last time, which is our period in history, the Yemos HaMashiach, the time of, hopefully, very soon, the coming of the Mashiach. So you got to keep those periods clear in mind.
Is it going to come on a Hamora, or is it going to come in an SUV?
I'm not sure exactly, but hopefully we'll see it soon. But you have to keep this closely in mind as we look through both the historic level and the personal and the other levels of meaning. I just want to point out, we'll leave it there for today, and we will start with the actual verses next week. Hopefully it will be a very exciting and a very spiritual and a very moving experience.